Working Men of the Pan-Sci-Cast, unite! Part 2, Internal Contradictions and Revolution. Hegel is massively influential to the philosophy of Karl Marx. Who was Hegel and what are his ideas?
Well, we're not going to spend as long going into the life of Hegel. In fact, I'm not going to talk about the life of Hegel at all, other than the fact we'll give you his date. So from 1770 to 1831. And we've already mentioned that he had a huge impact on the philosophy of Western Europe from his point onwards. And unlike Marx, perhaps, he was known at his time and he was considered to be a great mind of his time, and that then flowed onwards. So he wasn't in the position where Marx was, where after he died, people were thinking, who was this guy? And then we discovered him later. No, he was the prominent philosopher. His concepts have undoubtedly influenced Marx. But what's interesting is that Marx completely disregards most of what he gets at. Marx takes the core idea of what is known as the dialectic, and he turns it into a materialistic point of view rather than an idealist point of view. This bit here, I'm going to try and make this as simple as possible. Hegel is known for being incredibly difficult, and I won't even pretend to know everything about Hegel, but I've tried to do as much research on this to give it justice.
What did Hegel famously say on his deathbed?
Well, I'm not sure if this was directly on his deathbed, but he implied that even his most adamant supporter had not understood him fully at all. I think we joked about that when we talked about Kierkegaard as well, but a very hard man to understand. And that even when he was in the, apparently even when he was in the company of people, his ideas would be difficult to follow. So it's not like it was just his written word. He was a very intense analytic person.
In becoming an oak, the acorn ceases to be. The oak is not that acorn. The oak is the negation of the acorn, but implicit within the acorn was the potential to become the oak. The acorn thus contains within itself its own negation. In that sense, the acorn is contradictory? What's this all about?
What is this all about? That is, in essence, what the dialectic is. And to get an understanding of what the dialectic means for Hegel, you have to, I apologize for this already, we're going to have to go a little bit deeper, and then hopefully it'll make sense after we're all done. Hegel was an idealist rather than a materialist. Hegel is an idealist in the philosophical sense. An idealist is usually a monist, so somebody who thinks that there is only one substance to the universe or the world, and this isn't necessarily original to Hegel, not necessarily, it's not at all. The person who popularized this view mostly was George Berkeley, one of the famous British empiricists. Now, it's interesting, most people would think empiricism would usually imply materialism, but that's not always the case. Berkeley said that when we observe the world, really all we're doing is we're looking and our brains interpret everything. So he goes as far to say that everything is actually just ideas because it's the only thing that we know. Kant then latches onto a similar idea later on, and this is where Hegel really picks up his stuff. So Kant brings it into the philosophical movement of the German idealists. Some people would argue that Kant wasn't really an idealist in the normal sense. He's what's called a transcendental idealist. We're not going to discuss all of that. But what's important to note is that Hegel comes from a philosophical school of thought that says that, first and foremost, ideas are what make up the universe. But where Hegel goes different to, say, someone like Berkeley is that he thinks that it's not just the ideas that are interpreted through the mind. He thinks there is what could be called the idea, that he's what is known as an absolute idealist.
So to clarify that, Andrew, are you saying that Hegel believes that there is one substance or some kind of stuff, and that literally is ideas, not physical things, not mental processes or physical process, literally just ideas?
Yeah, and that's a weird concept, I think, in this day and age, but he does come from it in obviously a philosophical position. He's not just saying, I've decided this is the way it is. Berkeley's already said it's very hard to say that actually the material world exists in what we would usually say. He goes on to say, though, that what we just reference as the idea or ideas isn't just simple as just saying a human idea. He comes up with this concept, which is called Geist. Now, you might have heard the term Zeitgeist in regular term of phrase, and that's usually just referred to as the spirit of the times. Well, we'll come back to that idea a little later, but for Hegel, the word Geist is most usually translated in English as mind or spirit. Mind is, I think, the one that philosophers like to use the most because it makes it sound less spiritual, but actually scholars would argue that it's probably more fair to say that spirit really is what Hegel's getting at here, because there are certain religious or at least quasi-religious ideas coming through with Hegel. We're not going to need to touch on those bit. Now, why is any of this stuff important? Well, he thinks that Geist, because it is everything, it's an idea that he comes up with that Geist is trying or is not even trying. It's just inevitably unfolding throughout human history. So he doesn't think that the world is static. Things are constantly changing. And he thinks that eventually this idea of Geist will have developed so much that it'll become self-aware.
So this is the point of the dialectic, isn't it? What I referenced with the acorn.
Yes. Now, just to explain that exactly how he gets at, so he thinks that this idea of spirit is unfolding, and he thinks the initial process always starts with what Hegel would call a thesis. The thesis is the prominent idea of a time. What he thinks, though, is that every thesis has within it an internal contradiction, although that's probably a more Marxist way of phrasing the term, and that every thesis then eventually unfolds because of this contradiction. This contradiction is otherwise known as the antithesis or the antithesis. And what Hegel then says is that through a rational process of this kind of back and forth between the thesis and the antithesis, that what will develop is what is called the synthesis or the new thesis. Why is this useful to know? Because what it's saying is that history is making progress. For Hegel, this progress is the rational Geist unfolding throughout history, and that one thesis will be around, it will be the most rational way for a society to live, the antithesis will come and challenge it, and a new rational way of thought will come about, and that only until it reaches an end point will this actually finish.
So, Andy, am I correct in saying then Hegel believes in a Geist or spirit, and this spirit is expressing itself in the thesis, antithesis, and synthesis of ideas. So could we use an example for this? Or shall we say, this might be a bad example, please tell me if it is. So there may have been a thesis at some point, let's make our houses out of bricks.
What I will say there is that...
We should say that me and Ollie haven't read the Phenomenology of Spirit in near as much detail as Andy has.
So the material objects are perhaps a slightly harder way of doing it.
Use another example.
So what I think an easier way to look at this is to actually look at the big ideas of a time. Let's just go to state of nature because it's something we've already talked about in the podcast. Mm. So the state of nature would imply that there's kind of this maximum freedom. And in the idea would just be, so you have absolute freedom. That's the idea. Everything is kind of free and the take. And let's go with Hobbes's idea. So you can do basically whatever you want for own self-preservation. What is the internal contradiction with that way of living?
It's nasty, brutish, and short. So eventually it has the contradiction that we don't actually want it.
Yeah, you're completely free. So yeah, you suffer. You're in a constant state of paranoia and you can't handle the amount of risk and danger in that world, so therefore that's the antithesis.
Okay, good. So in a simple word, the antithesis would be safety, I would think. So you have absolute freedom, and then within that absolute freedom there is an internal contradiction that says actually safety might be better than freedom. So what ends up happening is that people submit to something, whether it's some type of sovereign. And actually, interestingly, this links into Marx and Hegel, is that they would say, you know, look at the ancient Greek period and the fact that slavery was just the way in which an economy was built upon. People submitted almost all of their freedom for safety in the act of slavery. And then that act of slavery would have its own internal contradiction, which is simply that to run an entire society based on slavery means that you have to constantly find new slaves, but that's not entirely possible because you either have to keep conquering new land or slaves keep having more and more children that end up being slaves. Eventually, and it did, it will come to a point where that's not sustainable. That idea will crumble and then the new synthesis will come through. So interestingly for Hegel, just to draw that back, he's not looking at the material process of what's changing there. He always thinks that it's actually an idea, a wide idea that maybe not everyone's fully aware of, but it is the spirit of that age, and that's what informs people. That's what dictates what society looks like. And then when the new idea comes in, that will change the face of the material world. Now, what he thinks is that will come to an end, because eventually there would become a point where there is a thesis so good it wouldn't have an internal contradiction. He thought that actually happened in his age. He thought that the perfect idea of the state was actually formed within the Prussian state that he lived in, which you can imagine the Prussian the state really enjoying. They were the pinnacle of what rational states should look like. And that if everybody went in line with what that state was doing, they would be living the most rational life. And for the individual, what ends up stopping any alienation, and we'll come to that word quite a bit when we're talking about Marx, what stops an alienation for Hegel with the individual is to come to terms with the fact that you are not an individual in the sense of that, like, your main concerns shouldn't just be about where you're getting your food or anything like that, or like how much money you have, because that could be very selfish in itself. What you need to do to avoid alienation for Hegel is to realize that you are part of a bigger whole, that you are part of the Geist. And once you have rationally understood that, you'll begin to realize, particularly if you're living in somewhere like Prussia, that you'll realize the state is also the most rational way of living, and that you will then almost be at peace with that's the way the world should be. That is why thinkers like Kierkegaard hated this idea so much, because in its essence, it is incredibly conservative. It says, here's the way the world is. You need to change your thoughts to be in line with the world. But if the world is not what you like, then to say that's just the way it is feels very anti-individual.
And very anti-synthesis and thesis and antithesis almost. It's quite interesting that Hegel comes up with this idea of ideas coming together and forming a new idea. And then within his lifetime, I can't think of any other thinker that believes that literally that was achieved in their own lifetime. And he actually was received awards from the Prussian government for, you know, promoting the Prussian state and being very pro-Prussian, thumbs up for Prussia.
But it makes sense in a way. He thinks that because he has discovered or thinks he's realized what Geist actually is, he thinks he's solved literally almost the secrets of the universe. He thinks he's understood where history had come from and where it has evolved out of and where it will cease to continue. So he thinks he's cracked it. And there were a number of people that also felt like he had cracked it. But that wasn't the case for everyone. We mentioned the young Hegelians. These people didn't feel like he had actually looked far enough ahead. They agreed with his analysis of history, but they didn't think that it stopped where the Prussian state was. They thought that more needed to happen.
I highly recommend episode 16, one of my favorites on Søren Kierkegaard and his analysis of Hegel's work as well as his own work and how he understood it at the time. Another influential figure which we need to discuss is Feuerbach. What are the views of Feuerbach and how does he influence Marx?
Yeah, Feuerbach was one of these young Hegelians that we mentioned, and he doesn't go along the full lines of what Hegel was saying, largely because, as I mentioned, Hegel thought that religion played its part in this state. In fact, he went as far to say that the Christian religion was the most in line with what this Geist actually was, perhaps potentially because there's already this idea of the Holy Spirit in there. And the one thing that Hegel did mention is that there is a risk of people just worshipping the Christian God might in some way alienate themselves from what Geist actually is. Feuerbach takes that to the whole new level. He's also concerned with alienation, but he thinks that alienation primarily comes through people's religious beliefs. So there's the iconic idea within the book of Genesis that we're all made in the image of God. Feuerbach flips that and says that God is made in our image, not the other way around. And he thinks that really what human beings have done throughout history is they have taken all of the great human qualities, the things that they want, and they've projected it onto this perfect being. And herein lies where alienation happens. You're constantly comparing yourself to this perfect being, wanting to be connected to it, but never actually being able to, because how could you possibly know or be truly connected to a perfect being as an imperfect temporal being? You can't do it. So what he then says is, human beings should scrap religion, because really what you're doing is you're noticing that there are really good qualities about a human being and almost saying you can't achieve that. But he thinks there's nothing stopping us apart from what we've put in place to stop us from doing it. And hence he thinks to be a unalienated, unestranged person is to take God out of the picture.
And Feuerbach is quite famous as saying that we, or human beings, imagine the Christian God or Jesus as a human, but actually a lion would imagine God as lion-shaped, that the attributes of human beings are what we want. You know, look at the traditional attributes of God, being all powerful, being all loving, nurturing, etc. These are qualities of human beings, and again, a projection of that. So just to clarify, so Feuerbach influenced Marx in terms of alienation. Does Marx agree in the Geist that Hegel was talking about?
No. And the reason why I'm bringing up Feuerbach here is that Feuerbach's like the almost intermittent stage is that they're both looking at Hegel's ideas and they're both concerned with alienation. But Marx does not buy into this idea of the spirit. He thinks that everything is material, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Just to really clarify it for the listeners then, he's influenced by Hegel in terms of the dialectic, and he's influenced by Feuerbach in ideas of alienation and his anti-religious attitude. So how does each individual thinker influence Marx? How does Hegel influence Marx? And then how does Feuerbach influence Marx?
Hegel ultimately influences Marx through the dialectic. He doesn't influence him on the idealism part of it, but the fact that history is an ongoing process of what could be referred to as a grand narrative, Marx takes and runs with it. And he also influences him heavily on the idea of alienation, that human beings have a nature that they want to be more in tune with, but can't do that because there is something that makes them feel separated from as a subject to the object. Feuerbach also brings in this idea of alienation, but obviously has a very much religious focus on it. We've already mentioned the fact that Marx is an atheist himself and somebody who thought that religion really was, well, an act of exploitation or helped exploitation with the people. So it's not hard to see how Feuerbach's ideas might have given him more thoughts on to distrust religion. Now, just to finish this bit off, I just wanted to quickly read two very short quotes from both of these thinkers, because I think they basically sum up in as short a way as possible what they could be saying. Hegel from The Phenomenology of Spirit, which is from 1807, each stage of world history is a necessary moment of the world spirit. So I think that encapsulates what he's getting at there, idea with the Geist. And for Feuerbach, this one here is from the Lectures of the Essence of Religion in 1845. And it says, by promising man eternal life, it deprived him of temporal life. By teaching him to trust in God's help, it took away his trust in his own powers.
So for Marx's history, it's not extremely pessimistic or optimistic. It's a pattern, but not in the Hegelian sense of a progress of the human mind. The pattern of history is to be understood through historical materialism. That's the process. That's the dialectic here. What's this referring to? Historical materialism.
Yeah, the really important stress on this first bit is what Jack's just alluded to. He's taken Hegel's idea of the dialectic and that this has been unfolding throughout history. But what Marx is not interested in is this idea that it is the Geist, this absolute mind that is becoming more self-aware as history unfolds. What he is interested in is the idea of the fact that history is just one economic class struggle after the other, and that each area of history is defined through an economic idea, or not even idea, let's scrap that idea and say just economic material existence. That's what he's concerned with. So if we look at the way he views history, we can see how his idea of the dialectic unfolds. So historical materialism is sometimes also talked about as dialectical materialism because it's still using that same process. I think this is worth going through step by step. It won't take too long and you should be able to follow it quite simply. So if we take the idea of what his version of the first thesis is actually kind of prehistorical in what his view of prehistorical actually means, which is the idea of primitive communism. And that's kind of what we were saying about this idea of the state of nature. And we've already talked about this, so we don't have to go on too long. So the fundamental internal contradiction to this primitive communism is that there isn't really any safety there. And out of that emerges what the new antithesis, or eventually the synthesis, would actually be, which is slavery. So then you have this, what I guess could be called the first proper historical society in the view of Marx. What do we say about the problem with slavery? What is the internal contradiction of this part of history for Marx? Remember, focusing on the economic real situation.
So he's referring to the ancient Greeks explicitly here, isn't he? He's a historian in the sense that he needs to appeal to moments in history to explain his historical materialism. So in ancient Greece, they had slaves. But what's the problem with slavery?
Well, slavery is immoral to start off with. I mean, focusing on the economic side, I think we're all pretty clear on this, that treating someone as property is immoral, but focusing on the economics of it, slavery is not sustainable. We mentioned this earlier, that slavery is something where if you take a group of people and enslave them, once they die eventually, where do you get your new slaves from? Do your slaves come from their children?
Or slave babies.
Slave babies. Or do you have to constantly invade and conquer other lands to have more slaves? Or what happens when eventually you can't find any more land? Or eventually if those slaves get really fed up with the idea that they are being treated so badly and being treated unequally as property and rebel.
That's it, isn't it? That's the rebellion. The slaves, the existence of slaves contains within them their own negation, which is the rebellion.
There is an element of that, but interestingly, there is also an extra point. I know that that feels intuitive, right? Mm. The class struggle here, and I think we should mention the class struggle at each stage, surely is the fact that you've got a ruling class and the slave class, and there's the struggle there. And that is definitely correct.
Right. So what is the internal contradiction there?
The internal contradiction of this stage of history is the fact that slavery becomes unsustainable. The example that is best used here is the Roman Empire, where they keep expanding to the point where they're trying to accumulate more land, more people, and that therefore more people can be used as slaves. But by expanding so far, they leave themselves incredibly vulnerable to attacks from barbarians, which obviously is what happens. And after these people start invading the Roman Empire is quite soon to crumble. And the emerging class that comes out of this, the people that kind of win the day and that become the new ruling class, are the kings, the lords, and the people underneath them are the serfs. So they're the people who are basically at odds with not having any property and have to live off the land of the lords and do everything that they are told to because it's a necessity for their existence.
So we've had the thesis, we've had the antithesis. So can you tell us what the synthesis of this is, Andy?
Yeah, and this is the prominent way of living throughout most of the medieval times in Europe, which is feudalism. So you have the kings, but they obviously can't see and be everywhere in the country all at once. So you have lords across the land that own huge parts of land that all of the peasants then live on and work on, and that anything that they do ultimately gets answered back to these people. Now, there wasn't a case to be said that they have literally no freedom, but the poorest people basically were farmers working for these lords. But at this time, and here comes the antithesis or the internal contradiction, which is that a new class began to emerge at this point, which is the merchant class, or what would inevitably become the capitalist class. So there are these people that start to be a lot more industrial, that they are beginning to expand. And this is just all across Europe. The trading connections country to country are becoming more and more consistent and easy. And so it very much benefits a country to want merchants to go across the world and do the trading and come back and benefit your country. But the problem with that, though, is what? If you have these merchants going around and they're earning a lot of money, what do they want that the lords can't offer them?
Land.
Yeah. They want to be able to keep their money. They want to be able to buy land. And why not, right? They are doing all the hard work. The lords are sitting around having all of the peasants do everything for them. This emerging class of workers who are actually quite intelligent, very industrial, and are making a lot of progress want to keep their profit. They want to be able to live a free life in that sense.
Viva la revolution. How does this link to capitalism?
Right. Well, at this point, we've got this internal contradiction of these new emerging classes coming through that the lords can't really stop. We then have, we get into the stage of the Industrial Revolution, really, where capitalists win the day, really. We have revolutions happening places across Europe, or the alternative is that essentially people like Charles II end up having to give up authority once again, and that you have democracies and republics beginning to emerge. But more importantly for Karl Marx is that you have people, these capitalists, who begin to own the land, the feudal system dies, and that everyone that was once a peasant now becomes part of what is known as the proletariat, which we've already defined, and that you also have these capitalist people who own the land, own the property, and own the industry. And that for Marx, this is the period of time that he lives in. So it's the bit that he writes about the most. And he talks about the idea that throughout history, we've kind of simplified it down there and said there was ultimately kind of only one or two classes. Not strictly true, but we're saving time. In the capitalist state, though, he thinks that we really do become to have this very polarized, like kind of one group against the rest, where the capitalists are the people who are perhaps few and far between, but they have all the money and therefore the power because they own the means of production. And then you have this massive majority of people that he thinks become the proletariat, all working for these capitalists. The feudal lords, they don't necessarily go away, but they obviously lose all of their power, and they certainly lose a large amount of their land. But you don't have to look too far in the UK to see that there is still that idea of like an old aristocracy lingering around that have tons of accumulated wealth over the ages. They're not capitalists. They might invest in capitalist ventures, but are they actually true capitalists in that nature? Certainly not at the time that Marx is writing. And then the thing is with this is that we pointed out the kind of internal contradiction in each stage. Capitalism becomes this new thesis, but for Marx, he doesn't think that there's any reason to believe that capitalism isn't going to end just like slavery did, just like the feudal system did. He thinks that if you look closely enough, or perhaps not even that closely, it's glaringly obvious to some people, that capitalism also has huge internal contradictions within it, which means that it's inevitable. Eventually, this economic system, this way of life, is going to fail. And that one thing that Marx does point out, though, is changing systems doesn't just happen by ideas. Remember what we said? Hegel might say that it's the ideas that shape the material. Marx is the opposite way around, or at least at first. He thinks that you need to change the material world to change the ideas. And that if you're not, slavery didn't just stop because slaves thought it was a bad idea. Like, eventually a physical force came through and made it so. And that the feudal lords wouldn't have given up their land just because it felt like the right idea. No, they were forced to by revolution. And that he thinks that capitalism isn't just going to change because people think they're being exploited. You need to actually stand up and say, we are being exploited and we need to change this.
It's very important that we realize that Marx sees capitalism as part of this great narrative, this historical story, which has happened since the beginning of the human race. And that he eventually believes that capitalism will fall, that there will be a antithesis, and that will lead to a new synthesis. He's very vague in terms of what that will be, but he does think it will happen.
The antithesis, is this the workers having something against their bosses, the capitalist?
Yeah, the antithesis within, or the internal contradiction within capitalism, is the fact that it is self-destroying, at least what Marx thinks, which is, and we'll talk about this more when we're talking exploitation, but in a quick summary, we're saying the fact that capitalism has within it a point where the capitalists want to make a profit, but they can't do that by giving as much money as perhaps Marx thinks is fair to the workers. So they give them quite a little amount and sell the products of their labor for a very high markup. And what becomes the problem there is that you overproduce, and not just that, but the people, the working people that you might want to sell these products to, don't have the money to afford them. And what ends up happening there is that you either expand abroad and that you try to you know, start globalization. We talked about this when we did business ethics. Some of the issues with that, though, is that, yes, while other countries might benefit, even now the working people, let's say in the UK, still don't really have much. They might actually lose jobs. That's the first problem. The biggest problem, though, he thinks, is that if people can't afford them, capitalists will come up with a short-term fix for this. And this is what credit is about. They say, here's all of this money that you actually don't have. You're going to accumulate large amounts of debt so you can buy the things we're producing. But just think about that. It's a system built upon the fact that people can't actually afford the product, so they have to be given debt to afford the products. And then more and more people are going to accumulate debt in different ways, and that eventually there is going to be a big crash. And we can see that throughout different times in history, in capitalist history, huge economic crashes have happened because there isn't, the money isn't there. It's just debt.
We should spell out the idea of exploitation at this point, I think. So I have a job and I go to work in my factory, and there's a certain proportion of my day, of my time at that factory, dedicated to necessary labor, right? So all of the work, the education I've had, all of food that's put into my body, the hours I've spent there, they should cover that. They should cover my existence and the work I've put into that. But there's a certain amount of work that I have which goes above and beyond that. So let's say I work 10 hours of the day for myself. I work that so the products I produce, and I can live off the profits which the company eventually makes. But there's an extra bit there. I work 14 hours. So this extra 4 hours, they're dedicated to what Marx called surplus labor. Work time that's in addition to the necessary labor. This is exploitation, isn't it? The extra labor that you give that is unnecessary. It's for profit.
Yeah, it's interesting that Marx, he works off what is called the labor theory of value, which is not an economic system that we use today, largely because economics now think it's a massively flawed idea. It's also not Marx's own original idea. Adam Smith produced this idea, amongst some of his other economic ideas prior to Marx. So he's building off it, but I think he's onto something a little bit. I don't agree with it entirely, but the way he sees it is, as you said, there is a certain amount of money that capitalists have to pay their workers, because if they can't pay them almost a living wage, something that they'll actually be able to eat, sleep, and return back to work the next day to work for them, then all you're doing is just kind of slowly killing off your workforce. So you can't do that. So capitalists are stuck with the problem that they have to pay a certain amount. So that's the necessary value that has to be paid to the worker. Now, capitalists, for Marx anyway, he thinks that they'll keep it as close to this minimum, or the minimum, that they can get away with, because they're about making the money. Now, Marx thinks, and this is where this labor theory of value comes into it, because the worker doesn't have anything else, they technically sell their labor value, their labor power, to the capitalist. The only bartering power that they have is their labor. So the capitalist pays them for their labor, and that's really all that they offer. Now, here's the interesting thing that he says. So he thinks that a product's value is placed on how many man hours, or average man hours, it would take to build this thing. So if you took the idea of a chair, maybe, let's say, just theoretically, the chair takes 10 hours to make, although it probably would take less than that. Actually, just for simple time, let's say 2 hours to make the chair. In that case, like, you could attribute any value to that, whatever the capitalist has decided. But if you had another product, like a table, that takes 4 hours to make, then the table is going to be more valuable than the chair. Not because of any external value that might be put on it. So like, if it was a particular brand of table, for Marx, that technically doesn't actually matter, because that's unquantifiable. That doesn't really exist. If the workers put in the time and they put in more hours to build the table than the chair, it's more valuable. Now, here's where the exploitation comes in, because what ends up happening is that a worker will put in a certain amount of time, and that these products will be sold for more than what they're actually putting into. And so the worker gets, say, like, I don't know, like £5 a day. And the capitalist will then sell on these products for vastly more than the money that is getting paid back to the worker. The reason why this is a problem for most people now, people don't think this is necessarily too much of a problem, because the general economic thought is that the capitalist is taking a risk and investing money, so they deserve some sort of return. But Marx thinks that the only reason why these products have any value anyway is because the laborers have put their labor power into them. The table wouldn't exist if the laborer didn't put their hours into it. That's what gives it value. However, what ends up happening is that the capitalist sells the tables and the chairs, makes quite a large profit off it, because they end up having, as Jack said, this surplus time where the workers are producing more than what they actually need, but aren't getting paid anything more for it. So they might get paid there like 5 hours a day at that time, which I imagine actually probably is quite a lot of money. But the capitalist is making tons of profit from this, because after the first couple of chairs, the workers already produced what they needed. And then all the rest of the time, they're continuing to work, say, like their 12-hour shift. And all of that extra time for Marx is surplus.
Yeah.
They're actually technically working for free, is what he would argue.
And there's definitely the focus on this unfairness, isn't there? So Marx is saying that it's the workers that spent the time building these chairs, building their tables, and they are not seeing any of the profit that the capitalist is making. It's the capitalist is making excess money while the workers just work. And even if they are very talented, they are not seeing any of that.
We're touching a lot on exploitation and nearly getting into Marx's ideas of alienation as well, which is part three, so we'll move on to that. In summary though, internal contradictions and revolution. What are Marx's ideas on these?
Very quickly then, he's a materialist, not an idealist. So he thinks that history is unfolding through different economic struggles, something that you can physically actually quantify and see. And he thinks that each economic age is defined by what he would call a mode of production, or the primary means of production. For slavery, the means of production is the slaves do all of the work. And there is an internal contradiction in the stage, in that it's not sustainable and that it would inevitably collapse. And then, so he thinks that it would unfold, as we said, to the feudal system, but then that would also have a contradiction, which leads to the capitalist system, which he thinks also has a contradiction, which would then lead eventually to communism, which is what he's arguing.
The next installment of this episode will be available on the following Monday. If you're yet to subscribe to the PanPsychast on iTunes, please do so. For more information on anything to do with the show or what we've discussed today, please visit www.thepanpsychast.com.